Welcome to the Mind Suite podcast presented by the Rambler Project. This is Mental Health Conversation Uncensored. Be sure to subscribe for weekly podcasts and check us out on all social media platforms at the Rambler Project. Now let's get to this interview. Enjoy. All right, so welcome back to an episode of Mind Sweep. Myself and we have Matt here as well, back and at it. And our guest today, Ben Finelli. And we're really looking forward to talk to Ben today about his brand, Heroic Minds, as well as his story that led him to do that, which obviously, Ben, you can dive into. I'm sure it's been a long road for you, but you know, you're out there changing the game for people and helping people and motivating people and speaking. And yeah, so I'd love you kind of maybe share some things about yourself and we can go from there.
For sure. Yeah, it's I'm right now presently an assistant coach of the men's hockey team at the University of Waterloo. I'm currently pursuing my master's in counseling psychology. And then similar to you guys, hosting a podcast, trying to dive into, I guess, where mine may be a little different than yours. You know, I kind of started with the very tailored resilience approach was kind of the main theme, and it's evolved in a really cool way, actually, into just simply people that have realized their life is an opportunity to be a hero for themselves, but then also a hero for other people. And those are, as you could tell or assume, I guess, that's really anyone. And so I've have conversations about a bunch of different things, from amputation to disease to being a minority to breaking edge research and trying to make social change. So it's been quite the journey. And to be honest, it's been a huge example of how much learning about other people allows you to learn about yourself. I came from the hockey world that is very much this siloed, everyone act the same, look the same, dress the same, speak the same, so you can fit in. And if you do anything different, you're soft and weak. And I was in that world. You get out of that world, and the things I've learned are just outstanding. And how it's made me better is just remarkable. So that's kind of in a nutshell who I am. I mean, what led me to the podcast really was an injury back in 2009 when I went through a serious head injury, which it sounds like we'll dive into here. But that's what really got me interested in psychology, neuroscience, human behavior. I think it's all outstanding. And I think it's super timely, actually, right now, not only because of the pandemic, but I think more so just because of the speed of life. And we're not biologically able to keep functioning at this speed, yet we continue to just speed it up faster and faster. So it'll be interesting to see where life goes. And it's even cooler, I think, to see where ancient wisdom's coming back and people are doing things that people did hundreds of years ago. And it makes them happier and healthier and simplifies things. So yeah, lots to unpack, obviously, in that, but that's who I am, and I'm happy to be here.
Awesome, man. And you know, obviously, we can start by kind of rewinding, and obviously, your story and what you've been through is a huge, huge reason to what you do today, right? And I'd love for you maybe to give a brief summary of kind of what happened in 2009 and the chain of events shortly after, and yeah, we can go from there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the reason I do what I do today, and I'm really trying to grow this thing, is because when I went through my head injury, I was supported by people that never had to support me. I was a 16-year-old. I'd played 7 games in the Ontario Hockey League. I wasn't a stud. I wasn't this, you know, star. You know, I had Jeff Skinner on my team, who was an absolute, for lack of a better term, weapon at the time, which I think is how people would describe him. You know, he went on to score 50 goals the year after, that year. So, you know, guys like that, John Moore, Jeremy Moore, and Ryan Murphy, the list goes on of the Gabriel Landeskog, the list goes on of who was on this team. Yet while I was sitting in the stands, unable to play, and every sportscaster in North America was saying I'd never play again, I had a community supporting me everywhere I went. So that's really why I'm so geared to make that into a living, this idea of giving back and empowering other people. You know, the dream is to be able to put food on my table by way of also empowering other people. And I hope that works one day. Am I there yet? Not quite. Do signs show that I'm moving in the right direction somewhat? But to begin answering the question, that's why I do what I do, is I had people support me from all over North America. I have a moving box full of letters still messages of hope and optimism. And that's that. So now going even further back, so why did I have that experience? Well, again, 2009, 7 games into my OHL career, I skate behind my net to pick up a puck, and unfortunately I get hit, my helmet cracked and fell off, and my head hit the metal stanchion that holds the glass in place. I fell to the ice and was airlifted in a helicopter, actually, first I went to the local hospital, then they didn't have the care I needed, so I went to Hamilton General, not too far from you boys, I'm sure. And so there, I was basically given the news when I came to, and this is all really blurry for me. My memory is not very good of the incident. So when I came to, when they took me out of a coma, basically told me sports were out of the question for the rest of my life. School was out of the question for at least 2 years, and that my brain was bleeding in 3 different places, which was pretty wild to hear, because I had no understanding of brain injury. Like I had no concussion. Geez, that wasn't even really a thing. That was go home and sleep for a few days and then come back to the rink. That's all that was. So that, to wake up to news like that was just, there's really no words I could put into it. But the one way I can try to explain it is when I got to Kitchener and where I was, you know, everyone in my life, my coaches, my agent, were telling me that I had a chance to play in the NHL one day. You know, just keep doing what you're doing. You've got the work ethic, you know, just the due process kind of thing. And you'll give yourself a chance at least to play in the NHL. And you go from that to, again, at 16 years old, where you think you have your life figured out, you're going to be a professional athlete. And then you're told not only will hockey not be in your life, but sports won't be. And then the school, and then you might behave and act differently. And the list goes on. So that's what I woke up to. Long story, super long story short, I took 2 years away from the game. When I say away from the game, I just wasn't playing. But that being said, I was very much involved with the team. So about 2 months after November, December, 2 months after the injury, I was at home. Then after that, in January, I started to get back to myself. And my mom said, you know, why don't you move back with your team and see if you can be a part of the team, maybe get back into school. And that's what I did. And I think looking back, that's a reason that was the beginning of one of the most powerful things I think that's ever happened. And obviously I already kind of told you why when I was back in the Kitchener-Waterloo community. So back to Kitchener, at this point, I'm still only allowed to walk around the block. Like I'd walk around the block, have a nap, walk around the block, have a nap. Then slowly got back into school, still doing my naps and my walks. And then that got into balance drills and juggling and word searches and cognitive challenges, which turned into a little bit of light weightlifting and just slowly pushed the envelope, slowly pushed the envelope. And at this point for 2 years, again, not allowed to play hockey, was on the bus, filling bottles, doing everything I could to be a part of this team. And 2 years later, lucky enough to be given the opportunity to return to play for the Rangers, which was outstanding. I finished 3 years with the team. I was lucky enough to be the captain in my final season and was lucky enough to go to camp with the New York Rangers after my fourth season, actually, which was outstanding. And then once I finally finished my career in the OHL, and I have a picture of the last time I played a, you know, true competitive game of hockey, and my we're saluting the fans at the end of my final game. And it was just, again, another experience where you can't put it into words, but I did know in that moment, okay, this is the end of me playing hockey. It's time to move on. But I definitely didn't know what that was going to be. I put so many eggs in that basket. Everything was hockey. I know what I liked, what I enjoyed, what I was good at. So that's where the next chapter of my life began.
Through that whole process there, because I had a very similar story. I actually went to York University to play basketball. And had a nasty fall actually in my freshman year. Then ended up having surgery on my elbow and my wrist. And for you guys that know basketball, like, I mean, without your hands, you're almost useless on the court. And, you know, we're thankful for healthcare system we have here. But, you know, even as an athlete and, you know, fast tracking the process, you know, you're seeing specialist after specialist, and that person couldn't help me. They had to see a plastic surgeon. And by the time you're getting all these surgeries, it's, you know, it's my second year of eligibility. By the time I'm getting surgery, then recovery is like, you know, 6 to 8 months, even for such small surgeries like that, then you're going into your third year. And as we know, as athletes, you know, new players are coming in, coaching changes, you know, system change, scheme changes, you know, you may not necessarily be the same player that you were, because there's just that whole physical drain on yourself, that whole mental drain on you. And that's kind of, that's what I'm leading to, is for me, it was a huge, that was kind of like my second biggest battle with mental health. Was, I think, like you put it in good perspective, that for young athletes, we put so many eggs in one basket that when that's taken from us, it's like, what do I do next? Like, how do I find myself? And that's a struggle that many athletes sometimes, like we see as what's happened to us, where it's stripped from us out of our control. And for me, like, I know you said you don't have much memory kind of the event itself, but take us through after that mental aspect. And yes, like when you tell to us, it's great. It's a massive success story, but we know that, and you know that it wasn't that easy robot to get there after 2 years of that struggle. Cause I've been there where it's like, you're on the team bus, but it's just not the same. You're sitting there, you know, it's like, what can I do? How do I keep myself mentally in check? How do I not go overboard and keep myself in line to kind of get where I am today?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the time, I didn't know what I was doing and why it was a healthy way to deal with things. There are a couple reasons why I was actually, in being honest, really able to avoid any type of, like, if I was sitting here and said, you know what, it was terrible and I was really in the dumps all the time and it was dark, mm-hmm. I'd honestly be lying a little bit. Was it difficult? For sure. But at the same time, like, my head coach, it was also the environment I was in, didn't allow me, and we talk about that all the time in businesses and schools, it's like a lot of the environment too that either enables someone and empowers someone to get over something. So like when I first came back to the team, my head coach, in a sporting culture where we're supposed to just be a number, yeah. My head coach, Steve Spott, who's now an assistant coach in Vegas, he said, Finelles, you're going to be a part of this team for as long as you signed your contract. So that means 4 years, potentially five. He said, you're going to be a part of this team in whatever role it is. Do I hope you play again one day? Sure. But we don't know that right now, and I'm not a doctor. So we're going to keep your stall in the room for the next 2 years, right, for the, in case you get back. And they did. Like, that is ridiculous in this world where you are, unfortunately, a number. And if you get injured, well, there's how many other guys waiting to take your spot? Yet, for whatever reason, that was empowering to feel involved still. Right? That's huge for someone's behavioral state. For mental health, what I call human performance. And so that was massive. It just goes further as well. I had 23 guys supporting me. There was no one saying, oh, why do we have to bring this guy along even though he's injured and can't play? They welcomed me into the room. At the same time, it was a two-way relationship where as much as it hit my ego pretty hard, I was filling bottles. I was on the bus. I was taking stats upstairs. I was doing anything I could to be a part of the team. But then that actually, to be honest, gave me an identity that was super empowering. Was I still the, you know, offensive defenseman I was up until 16? No, I wasn't that guy, but I managed to find a valuable identity still in that hockey room, which I knew so well. The other thing I didn't realize I was doing at the time that really helped with my mental health that I now know now with everything I'm studying and looking into was just really compartmentalizing the whole process, which I had no idea I was doing this, but I think one of the issues today in sport, in chasing anything, is that we're always told to look at the goal way far off, right? I know so many people, even real estate agents I've talked to, that are like, oh yeah, my goal is to have a Tesla when I'm 28 or 32 or whatever it is. Or we have these far off goals that are just daunting. And I'm not trying to get into the materialistic side of things. I just mean in any goal, we're told today to put that picture on your wall, right? Like having tenure and or whatever it is, or making it to the NHL. And even Hollywood paints it that way, is focus on that long-term goal. Well, what we know is that where you are compared to where you want to be, what fills that void is anxiety, apprehension, depression, anger, you know, that because you're not that, but we want to be there, but we're not there. So we feel uncomfortable when we're not. So that I realized that out of the gates, like focusing on, I wish I was back playing. Right. And in my mind, it was been two or three or four years in the OHL. And then I would have been off to playing pro. Well, here I am just being told I'm never going to play sports again. Yet I still want to get to professional hockey. So what was going to fill that void? Well, the list goes on, all the mental health issues you could think of. So what I did actually, and this was an accident, I'm no genius. I promise you that. But what ended up happening was I was so, it may be good that I can't sit still and that I'm fidgety, but what I ended up doing was just looking for things to do, anything to do that would force my brain to heal. And I got that theory from Lance Armstrong's book. He said he was going to work so hard, he was going to force the cancer out of his body or scare the cancer out of his body. He said, I'm going to work so hard, it won't even want to be here anymore. Which I'm not comparing a head injury and cancer. I'm not, but his approach, like I'm going to work so hard that I'm going to force my brain to heal. So taking that approach, it allowed me to compartmentalize everything. So I actually started doing a bunch of, I got into neuroscience. I got into social ventures. I was researching a bunch of different things I'd never, you know, been a part of in my life. But I thought, you know, if I learned about this, it might force my brain to heal. I got into aerobic training. I started training for triathlons. So a separate story, on a Friday night, I couldn't stand watching the game anymore. I was watching my 23 best friends play in front of 7,000 people. And I was told I couldn't be a part of it. And there I am sitting up in the press box by myself. And to answer your question directly, that was one dark, very dark moment of the 2 years away from the game or my whole journey. And I was just like, okay, I need to do something because this isn't healthy sitting here just soaking this in. I wasn't ready to work through it at that point. So I went down to my coach's office after the game. I said, Spotter, it's getting a little difficult for me to watch. Is it cool if on Friday nights I just, you know, I work out and you know, not, I'll be there before the game. I'll do all that stuff to be a part of the team. But since I'm not playing and won't be able to play, can I go do something else? So that spiraled into one of the most incredible journeys. But what it did was it made training for a triathlon a part of my life. So what I would do on Friday nights is actually go to the local pool and swim for a couple hours. And then the game would end and I'd get out of the pool. And then I'd text my teammates and say, hey, are you guys going for a bite to eat or what's going on? So it just, now the goal wasn't the 2 year off goal of him playing in the NHL one day. Now I was actually, it also gave me a sense of control. Like, okay, I can control the balance drills I'm doing. I can control, you know what, I can tackle 20 different things right in front of me right now that are, they actually gave me momentum because I was getting better at that stuff. So it took the focus off that long-term idea or dream of getting back to playing hockey. And I was just able to be the absolute best at what was right in front of me. So again, to say I knew that at the time, I didn't at all, but now looking at the research and how we're motivated as humans, and I don't want to dive into that too much, but the theory of human motivation, right? Like it, you know, coined out of Harvard, a Harvard doctor, David McClellan, achievement and human motivation is just like the closer you think you are to a goal, the more motivated you're going to be. So, you know, sitting in my room in the dark by myself, thinking about playing in the NHL, which was somewhat impossible, I'm probably going to feel pretty shitty. Now, if I think about being the best Sudoku completer or the best swimmer at the local pool that I could be, all right, you know, line me up. I'm ready to take that on and it's going to give me momentum. So obviously easier said than done. I was in an environment that allowed me to compartmentalize this whole thing. I had a ton of support. So I know that's a super long-winded answer, but to say I was in a dark place or really struggled that way, I didn't. I had people around me that didn't allow me to get there, and ultimately it really empowered me, which I think is the common narrative all the time, is people around us and the environment when really have the ability to positively influence how we feel, how we behave.
Wow. No, like what you said, though, is important, though, because it's something that, like you said, having attainable goals. And it's like this whole, you know, that whole SMART thing that you hear like in school and in business and stuff like that, and realistic, attainable, you know, timely and stuff like that, right? So it's like having that, well, like you said, like the NHL may have been out of the question for you, but it's like, what can I set myself weekly goals, monthly goals, daily goals that I know are attainable? Like you said, like, I'm sure you being the best swimmer at your local pool may have been able to be attainable in a few weeks or a few days or something like that, right? So like, okay, and you said, and you get motivated. And then that, like I said, that potentially may have been led to the trickle-down effect of you, you know, doing your triathlon and eventually even getting back into playing for Kitchener, because that may have just been in the back of your head that, okay, if it happens, it happens, great, but I'm not going to put this massive onus of pressure on myself that, hey, if I don't make it back to Kitchener, my life's over. Because like you said, that's where the issues with the mental health start creeping in, because then I'm not who I want to be, I'm not who I say I am, and that you know, like you said, this big picture that we all paint, we see in movies, we see in Hollywood, and even friends and teachers and family tell us that, you know, you go to school, go to university, get this job, and you're going to have a great family, and there it is. And then if you don't have that, then it's like, okay, what am I? I feel I lose my sense of worth, you know? So it's just, it's good to hear that.
You're bang on. Like, to quickly add to that and to finish the story, like, so being the best swimmer I could have been, or whatever else I had turned into something to accomplish, right? Which sounds a little crazy because it has nothing to do with hockey. And coming full circle, like those swims on those Friday nights, it did turn into a opportunity to do a triathlon, which actually, if you look at research now of aerobic training and neurological health, plasticity, neurovascular health, the list goes on, like aerobic capacity is huge for that. So who knows if by chance that helped, right? And then another thing that actually led me to was, and I won't go too far into this story, long story short, Lance Armstrong was coming to Waterloo. He's still, if I could meet anyone in the world, it would be him. Regardless of all the stuff that's happened, I don't really, that doesn't really bother me. If there's anyone in the world I could meet, it would be him. And so he was coming to town. He was good buddies with Jim Balsillie, who was part of BlackBerry. He was raising money for the Grand River Cancer Center. And I put out an email to a lawyer in town that I knew was involved and said, hey, is there any chance at all that I could meet him? You know, I'll swing by, I'll, you know, shake his hand and get out of there. This is the incredible community. There were some amazing individuals that came together with funding to basically fund me to be able to be a part of this ride. And so now I have a picture in my living room of me side by side with Lance Armstrong signed. And I spent 30 to 45 seconds on my bike chatting with Lance Armstrong that I'll never forget. Amazing. So that, and what that did for me was outstanding, but that all stemmed from me making the decision on that one Friday night where I could have just sat there, soaked it, been pissed off, gone home. But I tried to, you know, you have to get creative, find a way through this. And that's the one thing that frustrates me with the mental health dialogue narrative today is we somewhat reinforce how taboo it is the way we talk about it, because we'll say, you know, someone spoke up. It was the most incredible thing ever. They spoke up, right? And we make it seem as if, even though that is incredible because it is difficult, the narrative reinforces how difficult it is though. Yeah. Like, so we're just, it becomes a circle, like a cycle. Like, why isn't it, okay, he spoke up as he should, right? You break your ankle, you go get help. But we're talking about it in a, like, we want it to be like that. We want it to be like a visual injury, but we're talking about it in ways that it isn't. So that's why, for me personally, I call it human performance. You know, whether you're Gabriel Landeskog or you're an accountant or you're a single parent or you're all three of us on this call, the better you feel, the better you're going to perform as a human. So I don't care if it's schizophrenia, depression, or a Stanley Cup playoff game. Let's do what we can do to feel better, to perform better. And when we do that, we're going to treat the people in our lives better. And again, that comes back to a little bit of my own narrative or dialogue with being the hero of your story. But sorry to fit that in there. It, to be honest, does frustrate me. I think we're, as much as there are some incredible things happening in the world of mental wellness, human behavior, so on and so forth, the one place I want to see change is just how we approach it, how we talk about it, because you're feeling off, things aren't good. Like Landsberg says, who's a huge advocate in this field. I had him on the podcast, and a line I will never forget. He's like, dealing with this issue, and that's all types of mental health adversities. He said, it's like being in a street fight. And if you get kicked down to the ground in a street fight and there's a piece of glass beside you, what are you going to do? You should grab that piece of glass and do everything you can to save yourself. And when it comes to this entire conversation, it's like, okay, if something's wrong, whatever your piece of glass is, whatever you could do, just do it. Feel better, make yourself feel better. And I know it's not that easy, but I feel like if we change the narrative to that and make it normalized that, yeah, you deal with it, you find ways to do it, you get creative. I wish that was part of it more, but right now we're tiptoeing around the conversation and congratulating people for things that should be normal. So I know it's a touchy area and I may be speaking beyond myself there, but when I go to businesses and talk, that's the approach I take, is it's human performance. Like, let's make this a little sexier and marketable. Let's not make it as, you know, thin ice that it is right now.
I would say like bubble wrap. It's like bubble wrapped, the whole mental health conversation still, and it's protected. And honestly,
that's a good way to put it.
Myself, that's kind of our goal, is to like try and mainstream this conversation. And a lot of what we talk about, we don't even say mental health. We always just, it's just being, it's how things are. It's just because we all walk with some sort of struggle or we have family members, but you just hit the nail on the coffin. That really bothers me is why I was restricted so much to open up, you know, why Matt felt so restricted. We felt something was severely wrong with us that we were feeling a certain way as we were, but it starts with, you know what I mean? Even us three guys having this conversation about like, nah, like let's change this dialogue. Like this isn't acceptable because we know how strong, how tough it is though for people to be stuck in that bubble wrap because they feel like it's too gushy. It's too, like, there's just so much restrictions. And I agree with what you're saying for sure. It's like, it just starts with how you even speak around it, how you talk about it. It has to be more injected to the mainstream, and that's what we're trying to do. Right. So it,
right.
Yeah. I also
sorry. I'll just quickly say, go ahead. I would just say I haven't done this yet and I want to is go up like downtown somewhere, whether it's Hamilton, Oakville, Waterloo, whatever, one day, get the approval from people to be able to use this, but just find 10 people, like 10 random people, whatever demographic, it doesn't matter at all. And just say, what does mental health mean? Give me a definition. And I bet
Dan did something similar to this at McMaster.
Yeah, we did that. I did that at McMaster.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what were your findings? Was it like 10 different answers or?
It was more, I didn't really use mental health. I kind of more use the dialogue of success and like restrictions they have mentally. Like what kind of restrictions do you put on yourself? And there was some amazing answers, but a lot of people didn't really know how to answer it because I never dug into it, never thought about it. And that was kind of actually just ties me into our question I wrote down is like, obviously you're passionate about personal growth and kind of greatness within somebody else. How do you think it should be taught then moving forward? Because obviously like I never felt like anything came across my desk in the sense of like, hey man, here's something you can grab onto. Here's a resource. Here's help. Instead, it's like struggle. Or for you, it's like severe event. Or, you know, for Matt, it was like struggle to a certain point. And it's like, what would you like to see change moving forward? Because, you know, I still feel like obviously conversations like this help, but with kids coming through and hockey teams coming through and university students coming through, like, how do you think, you know, this information should be brought up and in what form?
For sure. I mean, there's a ton of different ways you could approach this question, and there's so many layers. I would say the two biggest things, one is realizing why and the meaning behind why you play. I would say, like, really, it's so much when you really break it down, like, it's so much deeper than just the game of hockey, and so much deeper than being the leading goal scorer. Like, so why do you want to be the leading goal scorer? And that's more of a philosophical talk. But when you really peel back the layers and like I've had to do with hockey, it was just, you know, there's so much ego involved. But then it's kind of like, okay, why is the ego involved? And then you really peel back the layers and you get real with people. And then it's okay, well, if you want to be like, why do you need all those people loving you? And why do you need all the money and the fancy cars that come with playing? And right? Well, it's exciting. Well, why? And you really peel back the layers. And with young kids, that's harder to do. So my answer is, as you said, with young kids coming in, I would say one of the keys is keeping things super real and down to earth. You know, when I was playing, you get so out of life. Like, it's so out of real life when you're playing. You know, I was lucky enough at 16 to 21 years old to play in front of 7,000 people. Like, we're in our own world. Like, you really are. And then your values start to change and your goals start to change and your what you feel grateful for starts to change and what gives you value starts to change. And so now when something does go wrong, when there is, you do have a bad 10 games, you do school's going poorly, but you still have a 3-3 on the weekend. Like, you're so far removed now from real life that it feels like the end of the world. Like, it really does. And then we sit back and, you know, we have players that leave the game without emotional intelligence because they've been stuck in just the world of hockey. And then players sometimes struggle and even as far as complete suicide. And then we chalk it up as concussions and say, oh, it was concussions. That's why, right? It was a fighter. So, okay, it's all concussions. And I know there's research on neurodegenerative diseases for sure, but a lot of other players chop it up as okay. And yet if you really dig back into it, well, there's a massive social component to this whole thing that isn't being discussed. And like I said, being in the silo of the hockey world, well, where are we learning the emotional intelligence outside of that hockey world? Because most coaches were players and those players were taught by other coaches that were players and the cycle goes on. So why don't we get out of the hockey world to learn this stuff? Why don't we get some real life, some more real life examples and experiences coming in? Let's keep it real, down to earth, what it actually is. It's a game. So on the sporting side of things, I'd say that's my answer. I think the same goes for investment banking. The same goes for any other career where you can so easily get sucked out of what life's all about. Which I think when you do that, when you are down to earth, now all of a sudden, and if I said this to any player I played with that didn't make it, or even that did, and I said, hey, what would you change if you went back? Oh, I wish I didn't care so much. And now these people are like that. That answer is across the board. I could bet my money, and I don't have lots of it, but I would still bet it on as many players as I could. I'd say 95% would say the same thing. I go back, I wish I didn't care as much. And if you really dig into that answer, now they've been forced to get out of the game. They've been forced to find new passions, get back to their feet on the ground. And now all of a sudden the game isn't so big. The game isn't this massive thing that's going to control your life and you're going to get all your happiness from this one little idea of a hockey game, or for you, basketball or whatever the sport is. So then it's interesting how ex-players say that. So I think, so that's one thing is get back to meaning, get back to the true meaning, peel back those layers. Obviously you have to simplify it a little more for the younger groups, but I'd say from 16 up, you can really, you know, benefit players in your team. And the performance goes up. When you don't care, your performance is going to go way up. The best basketball games you played, you weren't thinking, you were just doing. It was just buckets. You weren't even thinking left hand, right hand, right? Like it was just happening. And that's the same with, I mean, I would say with the hockey players and the stories I've heard from some of the best hockey players I played with. Now, the other side is just, and I won't dive into this too much, is just simplify execution of things. And I'm not sure how much you've looked into my stuff and some work I do, but when I go to businesses, it's all about how can we get out of our own way, right? We're in a world of let's make things sexier, let's do more. Let's make things more complicated. Let's try and control more variables. We have more science. We have more tools now. Let's control more. The more we think we have control of, the more attention we put into things that aren't that important. And then we lose the ability to actually execute. And so again, like I won't dive into this too much, but my second point would be to answer your question, how can you help and make a difference in the mental wellness and behavior of these young athletes or young people is just get out of your way. Stop trying to control so many variables. Stop, you know, thinking I need three more degrees. I need more tools. I need another sleeping app. I need this and I need another diet plan. And just no, peel back the layers and figure out why it's so difficult to sleep in the first place. Figure out why it's so difficult to hold on to that diet in the first place. Why are you so nervous before games that you need to spend hundreds or thousands of dollars on a sports psychologist? Like, it's not that you need a quick fix to play the game. It's that you need to fix the reason you're even nervous in the first place. No different than the sleeping issue, right? We say, oh, you can't sleep well. Well, have you downloaded Headspace? Not have you dealt with the conversation you haven't had with a significant other in your life that's causing the stress? We'll put a Band-Aid on it. We won't actually fix it. So to me, that's comes down to simplifying. You know, we get in our ways so many different ways right now in life. And you can see it. I think another one is the common narrative is work hard, work harder, right? No pain, no gain is like everywhere. And, you know, when you think about things and we go back to that ancient wisdom, no, it's the one that can, you know, sand down the edges on the square cube and slide it through the round hole that actually now frees up time to spend with family and free time to meditate or free time to go enjoy themselves. And that's just a very, you know, simple metaphor for what I'm trying to say. But yeah, sorry for the long-winded answers.
No. It's even like the, like you said, work hard, play hard, stuff like that. It's like, even now it's like, you know, work smart, not hard, right? And like you just said, the whole thing around the corners, right? It's like, why people say work harder, things are gonna come. But then it's like, okay, like, cause I work at BMO, right? So the investment side, the banking side, it's like, oh, okay. Like you tell your manager or your manager, once removed, your senior manager, oh, you know, do your time, you know, work for 2 years. Cause like at the bank, it's usually like 18, you know, if you've done stuff with banks and corporates, like usually 18 to 24 months, you kind of talk about promotion, you feel comfortable, you know, going to your manager, hey, I'm looking for a new challenge, stuff like that. Right. But then you're like, okay, well, why is that new girl going to a new role after 12 months? Oh, well, she asked me, or well, he asked me, and you know, they wanted to look into this. Well, you told me I had to work hard, and after 24 months, I can go do this. Well, you know what? You know, they're advantageous. They came on and asked me, and I said, hey, why not go for it, right? So that whole old age, you know, way of work hard, and things will come to you. It's not necessarily, you know, the key to success. And like it's like you said, how do we oversimplify? I mean, how do we undersimplify that? Because there's so much tools, so much news, so much education that, because the common answer too is like, and I was even just a victim of that, because I was saying to Dan's question, I was like, you know what, like maybe we need to educate these kids, but maybe there's too much education. There's too many sports psychologists. There's too many people in these kids' ears that they can't even think of their own actions. They can't even think of what they even truly like anymore. And I guess that kind of leads me to you, because you've had more probably, you know, more dealings than us, but it's like, what we're talking about is a perfect scenario, right? Like, what if, like, when you said, like, you unravel those layers, or you peel off those layers for these kids or even adults, and that band-aid they're trying to do for the quick fix, what if they're not comfortable talking, you know, to their significant other or their family or with their friends about these issues that are bothering them? Like, what have you come across kind of in your studies, or people you've dealt with who are experienced this, and what layers you're trying to peel off, but they really can't find the resources to kind of talk these things through?
So one of the most powerful things I like to start with when having a conversation along these lines is when we do get to the point where we peel back enough layers, all the different ideas of resilience, right? Like, I know people that go around and talk about the definitions of empathy and resilience and you know, all the buzzwords in these conversations, and that's not how you embody them. Just learning the definition of resilience, it's not going to be like, oh, okay, now I'm resilient, because I just heard an hour presentation on what the definition of resilience is, right? So one of the cool things, and I have a really, this might be a silly example, but to me it gets the point across, is okay, if we can get out of our own way, we decide to unpack things, we either go see someone we need to, and we're able to unpack things, or someone comes to us, like I had the incredible support I had. You deal with the crap, you get out of your own way, and then you actually don't even have to try to do it. Like, again, going back to this work harder and you know, reach out to as many people as you can to find all the help you need. And it's like, no, why don't we, no, let's simplify this. Let's talk, you know, let's like find one person or two people that we can unpack our issues with. And then there's something called the cocktail party problem, which is a psychology, I guess, narrative, is that we could all relate to this. So when you're at an event and there's, you know, 100 people in a ballroom and you're having a conversation with one person, there's another three groups of people all surrounding you that you can hear them talking as well, right? But if I said to you, hey, I want you to try to listen to the person you're talking to, but at the same time try not to listen to the other conversations going on around you. And so when we try not to listen to those conversations, effectively we actually listen to them, and it's becoming more difficult to ignore that and listen to the individual I'm talking to. But we have this natural ability in so many other ways, and this is just one example. When we don't try, this sounds crazy, when we don't try to do that, now we can ignore them, and now we're listening to the person. All we're doing is trying to listen to the person. I've stopped trying to ignore them, and now I naturally ignore them, and I can listen to the person I want to listen to. So that's just one example, and we have a lot of different, you know, neurocognitive abilities like that, I guess you could say. But to me, that's what it's about. It comes back to that, let's stop trying so hard. It's like when people say, if you're anxious, stop trying to not feel anxious, right? Like, you do something, oh, I meditated for 5 minutes, and you're like, okay, anxiety should leave now, right? Like, is it gone yet? Right? And you keep feeling for that anxiety, and that's going to make it more difficult to get rid of it. I've said to a couple people that have reached out for support, you know what the internet's full of is people having anxiety attacks, or people that just had anxiety attacks. But you know what there aren't many stories of? People that finally aren't anxious anymore.
Yep.
Because once you're not anxious, you're not thinking about not being anxious. You've stopped trying to stop feeling anxious, and now that you're not anxious, you're not going to go on the internet and write about it. So when people reach out, and I'm starting to do, I would say, coaching with some people, I'm not certified yet, as I'm just beginning my counseling degree. But what I usually tell people is, okay, I'm going to warn you right now, this is going to be quite simple. I'm going to try and peel things back, and we'll talk about meaning. But the tools we're going to talk about aren't going to be complex. It's not going to be having 5 apps and get up in the morning and eat 5 blueberries and then clap 5 times. And it'll be a life hack to, you know, loosen up your liver, and that'll change how you see the world. Like, it's not, it's all going to be super simple, and it's going to be something that you can apply. There'll be a couple of things you can keep in your pocket, and then some approaches to goal setting. But it all really comes down to getting out of your own way. Okay, you know, what, let's hear what you're doing right now. How are you coping with it? What's the mindset? And usually it's quite complex. And then that, just asking that question alone, a bunch of stuff comes out, and it's like, okay, so we can stop, you know, focusing on this, stop trying to get rid of this, right? Stop trying to fix this overnight. And ultimately, again, for lack of a better term, and not to keep using it, but let's see how we can get out of our own way here with this individual. So yeah, the biggest thing is, you know, goes back to that far off goal, you know, what's going to fill that void from where you are and where you want to be. No different than being anxious or depressed or nervous, right? I don't want to feel this. Okay, well, you do. So let's start there. Let's start that with that you do feel it, right? Not that you don't need to stop feeling it right now. You feel it. Let's learn about it. Let's work through it. Let's peel back some layers, find some tools to utilize. Not let's get rid of it as soon as possible. We're going to get rid of it. Here's what you could feel like one day. Like, no, that's anxiety inducing on its own.
Yeah, it takes work. And I think one word just to kind of, it kept hitting me, is just balance. And it even goes to your example of identity when you were just Ben the hockey player. And you know what I mean? That was still your identity. You were literally putting yourself like through the wall by watching all your teammates play, but that was your identity. That was you. It was just, you were one dimensional, right? Like, I played in the basement levels of junior hockey, but I still felt that was not my identity for a long time, man. And I remember, obviously going back to, like, you have a lot of friends in the hockey community, and I have a couple of friends who played in the OHL, and I know it is different than traditional junior hockey because of how intense it is, and you're doing homework on the bus, and it's just hockey, you have literally no off switch. But it's just like, that is like training these kids to be one dimensional, because look how many guys make it to the NHL. It's so small. Look how many of them have to have that wake up call when they get injured, when they get cut. You know what I mean? When their junior hockey career ends, or the university, or for me, it was, you know, my hometown Dundas Blues. When that was over, it was like, I was lucky. I still had a job, but a lot of these guys are like looking around like, so like, we're going to try out for a senior team, like senior A team. But I think, and this goes to mental health too, and it all about balance. Like, you brought up the anxiety point. I think that's huge, because I struggled from anxiety my whole life, and I hear people complain about me anxiety all the time and want me to give them one remedy. They want one dimension. But my system of kind of controlling my anxiety is a multi-pillared system. You know what I mean? And I think it applies to anything. As like an athlete, I think that's really important too. Like, for you, look, you like, you were literally struggling, like, oh, I'm just gonna skip a game, and I'm gonna work something out. That literally broke your identity. You started adding balance into your life, and then you started, you know what I mean, actually growing and then building and actually coming back to hockey as more balanced individual. And look what you're doing now, right? Like, it's something probably you never thought you would do as Ben the hockey player, you know? And same with Matt as basketball. It was like that basketball. But then that, in events in his life, right, Matt, it made you kind of blossom into what you do as an advocate and a banker. And you know what I mean? For like myself, it's an advocate as well. And as well, like, it's multiple balanced things. And I think that was like kind of really, really important. I just wanted to bring that up because I thought it was relevant with what you were saying.
Totally. I mean, to even carry on briefly, like, that is totally, when I said I've had these conversations with a lot of ex-players, I mean, even some I've recorded and they've been on the podcast, and all of them have said, going back to junior, and also to your point, it doesn't matter if it's AAA, AA, junior, this affects everyone. It doesn't matter if you made $10 million, if you made, you know, $300,000, we know it affects everyone. So regardless of the league. But when I, you know, when you think about players going through it, and the ones I've had on the podcast that have been successful, they've been there, they've made it, they've, you know, they're fine, they're financially, everything's good. What they could do, what they wished was, if they went back, one of the other things is that they wished they did other things. They wished while they were playing, they were, you know, instead of sitting at home playing Xbox, they were out at an accounting firm, a law firm, maybe a hospital, maybe a bakery, working with an electrician, learning about these other things. But now, again, now that they're out of that silo, it's like, wow, I wish I would have learned about something else. I would have had a bit of a different passion while I was still playing. And then what I always laugh about is, if I would have had, you know, the understanding I do now about how important the game really is, which I thought was absolutely everything, and to know I was going to have interests in other things like psychology and sociology and all this bizarre stuff I'm doing now, I would have worried so much less about how well I played. And then I would have played that much better because it wouldn't have mattered that I turned the puck over, that I didn't have a good game, right? Like, so again, would if I go back to that situation where I'm 18 years old, there's nothing more I want than to be a professional hockey player. And imagine someone just gave me remedies for anxiety. Would that have fixed it? And again, it wouldn't have because that wasn't the cause. The cause wasn't for... It was my life experience. It was how I was behaving. It was where my values were. It was, again, me not unpacking things and not peeling back the layers. So to do the Headspace app and to do changing a diet and to do fasting or to do whatever the quick fixes are today, that wouldn't have fixed the problem because that wasn't the cause of the problem. The cause of the problem was where I had my values and where I was situating my life and where I was, what I was chasing. I know that I've said that in a few different ways now, but again, it's kind of the Band-Aid fix versus the real thing. And I think what going to your point, Dan, about the balance, like there's a fix. Like put the little bit extra work in and figure out that life balance as opposed to whatever life hack's going to fix things for you.
I feel though too, like what you said, that the whole balance act, Dan, is like the identity crisis. It's like, you know, when these accidents or these injuries happen is because like we touched on earlier, is putting all your eggs in one basket, is that because, and again, like I say this a lot too in previous podcasts, like trauma happened to my life, and for me, like my brother passed away at a super young age, and then that kind of really changed my life. Now that my first battle with depression, then, you know, the identity crisis with basketball, it's like I don't wish, of course, trauma, and neither do any of us, but it feels like from us and different unique situations, it's like trauma or in our life essentially shaped our navigation to our rerouted our lives to kind of where we are now. And it's like, obviously I'd wish things didn't happen in my life, but then the silver lining is I'm able to be on a podcast with individuals like you. I'm able to be more in depth with my feelings and be more sensitive and to help others and to do these things and to have these conversations. But it's like, how can we, you know, they said, release this guard, have this less taboo. And, you know, like you said earlier about, you know, your physical health is just as important as your mental health. And never forget, because I do a lot of work with Kids Help Phone. And one of it is that, like, you know, they had an individual, a young girl, come on and make a phone call. And she said, you know, I'm going through all these issues. I don't want to tell my parents, things like this. And the crisis responder said, well, you know what, if you broke your leg, would you go tell your parents? And her initial answer was, of course I would tell my parents. So the same thing, if you're struggling mentally, if you have anxiety, have any type of either, you know, issues mentally or things like that, or cognitively, like you should be going to someone that you trust. And then it kind of like, you know, an instant pause, like, oh, you know, well, yeah, you're kind of right. And like, that's the thing. It's like having like your mental health, your mental well-being and things like that as is important as your physical health. And it's like bring that as so having it less taboo. So it's not like, because you guys would know way more than me, and like, you know, the cliche and the stereotype of hockey culture and what that like and being sucked into that, how it can be draining. And you're trying to fit in, you're trying to be this individual who people are supposed to perceive you as, that if you come out, Ben probably back then, like, again, it seems like you had a great support system, but if you came out back then and said, hey, guys, let's talk about our feelings on like a Friday night. Like, how are you guys feeling? You know what I mean? Like, you'd probably be getting crickets and be like, Ben,
yeah,
Ben, what's in your soda, man? Like, are you okay? Right. And it's like, right. It's stuff that what you're doing. And, you know, you have probably a more stronger clientele and individuals coming on your podcast. And it's like us, you know, hearing that, like, humanize it. And it's like, it's okay, you know, for us to kind of go through these things.
One of the points I made, I was doing a presentation actually at McMaster, I believe. And one of the things that came up in a talk on the stage was, you know, a lot of work in mental health, and I would say even say counseling. It's actually cool that the counseling world is really innovating, I'd say, in how and where people are doing counseling, because for so long it was, oh, you're struggling with something, you have to go see a counselor or a psychiatrist. And that totally, visually, you think about it, oh, okay, I have to go sit in a tiny office with no windows and two chairs and a table in the middle separating me from this guru that's going to change my life in three meetings. Like, that's what the kind of connotation is, right? And the reality is, that's not really what it could be. It could be you talking to a friend over a Coke at lunch. It could be you sitting on your bikes after a ride and unpacking something, or on the car ride to the cottage having the chat. And maybe your kids are in the car, your siblings are in the car, and you open up about something and people are like most of the time now, especially today, when people open up about something because of the narrative of mental health, mental wellness, people are like, whoa, I respect you for bringing that up, man. Let's talk about it. Wow, that's interesting. I'm intrigued. Like, it's almost like, teach me. You know, initially for me, what got me so fascinated about this, and even on the podcast, was I was asking questions because I honestly didn't know the answers. Was, what does that feel like? You know, when you go through that, or being in the shoes you're in, like, let's unpack that here on a podcast. Like, we're not, this isn't a counseling setting. This isn't a daunting hospital room. This is just shooting the shit and a little bit of a conversation, casual conversation here. And I wish there was more of that. And I definitely do that in my life with all my buddies. We unpack stuff all the time, you know, breakups or career stuff, fears, uncertainties. Like, for me, as long as it's in a setting where there's not people that shouldn't be there hearing personal information, geez, I unpack it everywhere I can now. Right. I was just doing work with a buddy, some contracting work on a day off. So I was helping him move some sod, and it's like, we're covered in dirt. We got mud all over ourselves. We're sitting on the mound of dirt, moving rock. And it's like, we have a conversation there and we unpack some stuff together. It's just, I don't know. To me, that's way better. And you're probably more invested too, and less, you don't have your guard up as much too, when you're in a nice setting, other than, again, one of those rooms that I think we could all relate to. So.
Yeah. I think we lost Matt somehow. I don't know if his phone died. Oh. I'll see if he comes back in. Oh, there he is there.
Okay.
But one thing I wanted to add to that, what you just said is so true, is like, literally even just the dialogue, like how we treat it. Like, a lot of people say, oh, well, you should go see someone. Oh, have you gotten help? And like, as a friend, like a lot of friends just like deflect. And
yeah,
that's not a good support system. And that's why people say, oh, you need to get help. You have to ask someone. It's like, because we aren't having these conversations, especially as guys. Like, a lot of my friends, it's very tough to some of them to sit down. Even some of the guys, a lot of guys who I played hockey with are like my best friends still in my life. And I know for a fact, some of them at 25 years old still can't have these conversations. And there's certain friends, it's weird though. There's certain guys I can talk these issues about all day. There's certain guys that I can't, because they don't know how. They feel, it's like cracking, what you say, layers. It's so deep in their core. And I know they're struggling. But it's like, you try and just slowly crack away. And it's like, when you have those it shouldn't feel so amazing when you're having these conversations on a dirt pile. It should be normal, right? And that adds normal to what we're talking about, right? And it's
totally.
Matt, are you there? Sorry, bud.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. Yeah, we were just briefly.
I tried to just transition that in, like, yep, nod my head. Yeah, Blake, you guys go. And I'm good at that. So don't worry. That was my fault.
Your photo was gone. So I'm like, is Matt here or gone?
So don't worry. We're good.
Okay, good. Yeah. So that I would love to see, and there's some incredible research. And I mean, that's where the one thing I'll tell people is I'm not a professional. I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel. Quite frankly, I'm trying to do the complete opposite, is bring back some of the oldest, you know, ancient wisdom, philosophy, science that we really know is quite, works quite well. I'm by no means trying to innovate in this space. And I'd love to see, you know, the difference between that, Dan, and what we just kind of briefly chatted about. So if I go, you know, my buddy's dealing with X, Y, or Z, and we're moving rock one day or on the way to the cottage, I honestly wonder, and I honestly don't know the answer to this, what is the difference between the benefits or detriments to having a conversation there casually about an issue versus in a room with a specialist that I don't know that well. And I know those people are valuable, 100%. That's why they exist. And I know I've gone to counseling and it's been life-changing. So don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to downplay that role. But if we can't go there, you know, we want to talk. We're not, you know, we're maybe that person's not ready to go to counseling or therapy. Well, I'd like to see the differences between, you know, doing counseling or just simply unpacking with a buddy, right? Like, I know the individual may not be, you know, trained to deal with it, but what about just simply talking about it? I don't think it needs to be in a hospitalized setting or, you know, setting of that such. So yeah, my own two cents. I don't know what the answer is.
I feel like the leading by example helps. I'm not sure you guys touched on earlier, but leading by example. And I know just from like my own personal standpoint is Dan obviously knows the story well, but when my brother passed away, I went, I got admitted to psych ward and things like that. So I was there, I was suicidal and depressed. You know, I was in there for about 3 months, and we know how nasty kids can be. And, you know, when I came back, so it was my grade 9 year, my brother died the summer of me transitioning. So, you know, going through that whole thing itself, going to high school is like this massive big deal. So that was huge, having that kind of life-changing experience. But I was telling kids I had mono. Like, I felt like that was the easiest thing to say, get kids off your back, because no one really understood mental health back then. And it wasn't until, like, let's say my brother died in 2008. So it was 4 years after all this happened. I was in the hospital that I finally went on Facebook and told everyone what had happened. And since then, that's led me onto this advocacy work that I do with, it's been with York, with Bell Let's Talk, with Kids Health Phone, even at BMO and things like that. And I feel like when people see that, and what you're doing, Ben, and what Dan started with Ram, or what me and him are doing with the podcast, it's creating that less taboo, as we, I kind of was talking before we got, I got cut off, and things like that, where we are kind of all, us three here are leading by example, and it allows to kind of plant that seed in others' heads, maybe who are reading or who are seeing us or hearing us, and hey, it's okay. Like my buddies, and they come over, you know, all the time, and we're like, yo, how are you feeling? Like, literally, not how are you feeling, like, how are you actually feeling? Like, no, like, mm-hmm. Hey, yeah, I had a good day at work, you know, me and the girlfriend are good. Like, no, like, what are you really going through recently? Like, you know, and the unique thing, and it's not a good unique thing, but we're all experiencing or some type of suffering from COVID right now. Mm-hmm. And it's really, an easy segue to kind of transition. Like, yo, how are you dealing with it? Like, you know, are you affected throughout your job, as your family affected, you know, do you have any elderlies who have been affected or things like that, where you can have these conversations and maybe that peels back one layer, like you attest to a lot, and that keeps maybe going. That domino effect of that conversation just gets sparked, and it's why it's important to, you know, what you're doing and what Dan's doing and stuff like that, and to kind of hopefully unpack this and start with your inner circles, and then it branches on from there. And I'm not sure about you guys, like, you know, like my parents still, like that generation still does not, you know, love talking about these type of things. And now starting to instill that myself, you're seeing them, but their friends, like this is nothing that's talked about.
I think you're bang on. I mean, imitation's huge in life. Like, how much do people, I think that's one of the things marketing's built on, right? Is LeBron James wears a pair of shoes and then 6.8 million people buy them the next 3 days. Like, we love to imitate as people. We see someone do something courageous, something powerful. And I don't know the psychology. I know there's explanation to it, and I don't know it off the top of my head, but there's something powerful in us where, you know, a bit of that affiliation kind of imitation, you know, sets in, and we want to do the same thing. And I think you see that a lot. I mean, Landsberg, again, going back, and I'm sure there's individuals, you have listeners that the same thing, like, wow, Matt and Dan are, you know, quite courageous guys to be talking about this stuff. And they're probably now doing the same thing. Hey, I heard on, you know, the Rambler guys chatting about stuff, and that, like you said, it's the, you know, cascade effect and the trickle down effect. So I think you're bang on with that.
Yeah, no, kind of, I know you said, just looking at time here, but is there anything else you want to share? And actually really quick, I have one question for you. So far, like, within your journey and what you're doing now, like, what drives you? Like, obviously, like, you're wearing many different hats and you're on one path right now, and it seems like you're just so driven, you're so motivated, you're so obsessed with helping people and understanding. Like, when you wake up, like, what keeps fueling that fire?
That's an awesome question, and I really appreciate you asking that. Something that really fuels me is, I think, from the science side, and we're just figuring out plasticity of the brain, like that the brain can actually, you guys probably know a little bit about that. I'm not a neuroscientist. I don't know much. All I do know is that they basically realized that, you know, the brain can create new pathways and it can be resilient. For years, we thought that was an organ that once it's damaged, nope, no fixing it. And so that's just, we don't really know how capable the body is from a physical standpoint, seeing as we just, I mean, in looking at things over the span of time, like, not that long ago, we just realized that the brain can actually, it is plastic and it can change and it can improve and can heal and recover. Obviously not everything, but that can happen. So if we're still realizing how resilient even physical parts of the body are, and then you hear incredible stories people breaking scientific, you know, consistencies of, oh, they shouldn't end up okay, they shouldn't end up happy, they should struggle. Yet those are some of the most resilient people that to exist. So we just don't know how resilient people can be. And this whole pandemic's been, you know, hammered things home even more for me. Is I can't even articulate how lucky I am to be where I am in life and have, you know, and I, like, I don't know what else I could ask for. And then I look around and I see some people that, you know, may not be as well off, whether it's financially, emotionally. And I wish I could grab all those people, not physically, but I wish I could go up to all those people and try and spill out everything. I wish you guys could come with me and, like, let's go find each person and just empower them, because none of us know how resilient that person can be. And to me, that's the most motivating thing ever, is that we don't know. We just don't know physically or psychologically. We don't know how resilient and how powerful we can be. So that's one thing that pulls me out of bed every day. And then the last point that I hate to say this, because it sounds, and now that I've said it so much, it sounds kind of cliche, but I'll use the Alex Trebek example. You know, people think to be a hero for someone else, you have to overcome extreme odds. You have to win seven gold medals. You have to be, you know, the highest point leader. You have to overcome incredible things and be successful in this to be someone's hero. But I, again, going back to the Alex Trebek example, when he was diagnosed with cancer, quite serious cancer, I believe. I'm not sure exactly what type it was. He came out on the media and said, "Hey, I'm going to fight this. And I appreciate everyone that watches Jeopardy. I appreciate you understanding this and hearing this message from me first. Here's what I was diagnosed with. I don't know what's going to happen, but I just want everyone to know that I'm going to fight this thing." So in that moment, technically speaking, he hadn't overcome the cancer anything. Physically itself yet, or you could say anything for that. I think you could, I mean, there's a little bit there of overcoming.
Sorry, I meant like in terms of the cancer, right? Like
I know. Yeah, and yeah, Matt, right? That's what I've said the same thing as you, right? But in that moment, it's like, technically you could say that 100%. He hadn't overcome anything yet. He recorded a video and said he's going to fight something. So if that's true, and other people would agree too, okay, he's got a huge hill to climb, but just approaching that challenge and just taking on a challenge, instantly he became, I'll be honest, he became a hero for me. And I'm sure he became a hero for thousands of other people. He didn't even overcome anything yet. He didn't accomplish anything yet, other than saying, I'm going to try. I'm going to take this on. I don't know where it's going to go. And so, to put things, you know, simply, is that when you decide that you're going to be the hero of your story, the hero of your life, however you want to word it, but when you make that decision, instantly you become a hero for other people. And so I've taken the approach that every day, like, wait, in my own control, in my own head, something I've control over, those thoughts, I can decide to be the hero of my own story, and that makes me a hero for other people. Geez, show me the challenge. Show me the people I can help, because I'm gonna be there and I'm gonna do it. So that's definitely what pulls me out of bed, is just an opportunity to be a hero for other people. And you don't have to be a millionaire. You don't have to have overcome crazy things. You just have to be willing to take something on, and maybe that's helping someone else take a challenge on. So, yeah.
Oh, that was an awesome.
Yeah, no, man, that was absolutely powerful. And I know Dan may say something there, but no, man, I'm actually happy. Like, I know conflicting schedules happen, but I'm like super, super thankful to have you on. It's refreshing to hear people who are so passionate and, like you said, determined. And, you know, you really are looking to find the resilience and the heroes in others. And, you know, like you said, we don't have to compare ourselves as celebrities. Us and quote unquote regular people can still be heroes to each other. And it's nice to hear that, man. It's like, it's a breath of fresh air. And during these tough times, you know, it's nice to connect with people like yourself. And thank you for taking, you know, the time to be on with us today. We appreciate it more than you know. And, you know, Dan, if you have anything else to say, or Ben yourself.
Yeah, Ben, thanks so much for coming on. Once again, I remember watching you on the Sportsnet feature years ago, so I think this is really cool for me to have you on. One last thing, is there any way, how can people reach you? If someone listens to this, hits them on the head, how can they reach you and get a hold of you?
For sure. So the easiest is just type in Heroic Minds on Google, and either the website or my social media will pop up, and you can find me that way. Contact through the website. Again, social media, send me a message is the easiest way. That's pretty much it. The other subtle little plug I'll throw in here, is through Heroic Minds, something that I've started that's going in a bit of an exciting direction is Heroic Apparel. So okay. I've started creating some, I just found a little bit of a hole in the market, I guess you could say, but offering apparel, and you can see the hat I'm wearing right now. So okay. Something I'm doing right now that's a little fun is for $8 with free shipping, a little play on this whole Heroic idea is someone can go on the website, heroicapparel.live, and they can ship a hat to someone in their life that's been a hero to them. So they go on the website, they type in a little story. You know, for me, I've got tons. I wish I could just send out hundreds of hats to all the people that have been a hero to me, but anyone can go on the website.
That's cool.
As you check out, it'll ask you to fill out a little story. Who's this hat for? What's their address? You pay the $8, and then on my end, I'll put that story and say, hey, you know, Dan sent you this hat. He said that you were a hero to him at this point in his life. This is his way of saying thanks. That gets shipped to the person's doorstep. So if anyone listening right now is a hero in their life that they want to send a little gift to, and you've got $8 laying around, you can head over to the website and they'll get one of these sexy hats right here that I'm wearing. Little subtle little plug there, but I had to put that in. It's needed, I think, at this time with so many people doing heroic things that, you know, now Starbucks baristas and people that maybe weren't as valued as much before are getting the value they truly deserve. And it just goes to show there is a hero in everyone. So, And thank you. You guys have been outstanding. I feel like we could have talked for another 3 hours.
Oh, yeah.
We're so on the same page. So that being said, I even on my end with people on the podcast, I've always said, you know, I may circle back for another conversation. So if anything comes up where I can help out or we can connect again on a future date, feel free to reach out, and I might do the same with you guys.
Yeah. Love that, man.
That's awesome, man. Thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of your night, man. Thanks.
Enjoy the night, Ben.
Thank you so much, guys. Best of luck with everything. This was absolutely awesome. You guys are doing something special here. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks,
Ben.
See you,
man.
Thanks. See
ya. Have a good one.
Be sure to subscribe for weekly podcasts and check us out on all social media platforms at The Rambler Project.